Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Inflation, rising interest rates, volatility. Whatever markets have in store, a financial advisor can help. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat the story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Monday, the 16th of October, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State has urged Israel to do everything possible to avoid harming civilians as it prepares for a major ground offensive into Gaza. The Israeli government says it's restoring water supplies to southern Gaza, although there's no electricity for pumping stations. In other news, as we record this podcast, the votes are being counted following Poland's general election, with exit polls suggesting the right-wing Law and Justice Party may be forced from power. Also in this podcast...
If I can do that scale, I know I can do it. And then I'll start with that.
Oh boy. Hiya, pal. It's me, Mickey Mouse.
I'm Brett Iwin. I am the official voice of Mickey Mouse, and I've had that distinguishing pleasure since 2009.
A major exhibition opens in London celebrating the centenary of the Walt Disney Animation Studios. It will then tour around the world. We start with the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who has warned that every precaution must be taken to avoid harming civilians as Israel prepares a major ground offensive in Gaza. More than 2,600 Palestinians have now been killed by Israeli attacks on Gaza since the Hamas assault on Israel just over a week ago. Then 1,400 Israelis were killed. Mr. Blinken added that Hamas's vision for the future of the Middle East was one of death, destruction and terrorism. He's been holding talks in Cairo with the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Before leaving Egypt by plane, the US Secretary of State spoke to reporters and stressed that Israel should do everything possible to avoid civilian casualties.
Israel has the right, indeed it has the obligation, to defend itself against these attacks from Hamas and to try to do what it can to make sure that this never happens again. As I said in Tel Aviv, as President Biden has said, the way that Israel does this matters. It needs to do it in a way that affirms the shared values that we have for human life and human dignity.
Well, this was what Egypt's president had to say after the two men met.
The current crisis is a drastic one, and I believe that the ongoing retaliation goes beyond the right to self-defense for Israel and amounts to the collective punishment of the Gaza Strip, home to 2.3 million Palestinians.
Another topic on the talks in Egypt were the efforts to open the Rafah crossing. That's the border crossing in the south of Gaza, which is controlled by Egypt. So what's the current situation regarding that border crossing? I spoke to our diplomatic correspondent, Caroline Hawley.
It's hard to know. I think what we know is that Egypt wants the crossing open to get aid in, because there is aid basically just backing up now in the Sinai Peninsula. What Egypt doesn't want is a mass influx of Palestinian refugees, but I think they are ready to allow foreigners. The US and the UK are saying they're working to get it open because it is the only viable route in and out of Gaza, and concern, as you just heard from President Sisi, about the humanitarian situation is mounting. Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has been hearing in pretty much every Arab capital is alarm at what Israel's doing.
And on Iran's possible involvement, I'm just looking at the Reuters news agency here, and we're hearing a warning from Iran's foreign minister saying that the US will suffer significant damage if the Gaza war spirals into a bigger conflict. What about this issue of Iran's possible involvement, a possible escalation? How much of a focus has that been for Antony Blinken today and others in the Biden administration?
Look, it's a massive fear. It's the reason why they've sent a second aircraft carrier to the region. The big fear is what we've seen is skirmishes along the border between Israel and Lebanon. And in Lebanon is the Shia militant group Hezbollah, which is a proxy of Iran, and everyone is trying to make sure that Hezbollah doesn't open up a second front that would really make this war spill over into other countries. So what we heard from the Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, was, these were his words, if the Zionist aggressions do not stop, the hands of all parties in the region are on the trigger. Well, that's very clear that they're on the trigger because of those skirmishes we're seeing in southern Lebanon and northern Israel.
And just quickly, Tony Blinken, I think, extending the trip and back in Israel, presumably for more talks, maybe with Bibi Netanyahu as well.
Again, I think the Rafah crossing is key just because of how concerned all Arab countries are. He is hearing warning after warning after warning about the risk of this spreading if the plight of Palestinians isn't taken into consideration as Israel responds.
Caroline Hawley reporting. Well, Jordan is another country that's always felt the pressures of the Middle East conflict very directly, as well as the history, with the wars in 1948 and 1967. Jordan is now home to over 2.5 million Palestinian refugees. King Abdullah is currently in London at the start of a European tour, and on Sunday he met the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Recently, he has issued a statement saying that the UK stands with Israel on its right to defend itself. His statement, though, did not mention the situation in Gaza. Travelling with the Jordanian delegation to London is King Abdullah's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi. Owen Bennett-Jones asked him if Jordan was satisfied with the British position on Gaza.
What we all need to do is to stand with the right of all peoples to live in peace and dignity and security. What we all need to do is to work together to stop this madness that is engulfing the whole region and stop this catastrophic human loss of life. And to what we all need to do is to prevent this terrible war from engulfing the whole region.
I mean, I totally understand you're arguing for de-escalation and to get back to stability. What I'm trying to get at is, you know, you're Jordan in the middle of this. Are you thinking that the Western government's positions are helping you do that, or are they too one-sided?
I think emotions have been high. The trauma of what happened is understandably difficult, but I think it is our job to think of the enormous cost this is bringing to the whole region, and it could even get worse. I think when it comes to our morality, it should be one. Palestinians and Israeli civilians are civilians. They need to be protected, and I think We in the Arab world in Jordan came out very clearly in condemning the killing of civilians from both sides. Our shared human values, our ability to move forward requires that the whole world comes out very clear in condemning the killing of both Palestinian and Israeli civilians. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that yet. Why is it a war crime to deny food and medicine and water to Ukraine? But it is not the same when it comes to Gaza. I think we need to make sure that we are all on the high moral ground here.
I think it's widely accepted a ground force is going to move into Gaza. And one way to protect civilians would be to let them out into Egypt. Would you think that's a good idea?
That's a no in the most affirmative way. Memories of 1948 and 67 are still pretty much there in the region. Population displacement, population transfer will not solve the problem. What needs to be done is to stop the war and to make sure that Gazans are safe in Gaza, and trying to transfer the crisis I'm sorry, but we have to be honest with each other here to transfer the crisis that the absence of hope and the consolidation of occupation has created to other countries in the region is an absolute no.
Well, you say that, but I think from Israel's point of view, they would feel a lot safer if those people were moved.
And the whole region would feel less safe if this war continues and if we do not create a path to a peace for both Israelis and Palestinians.
You have 2.6 million Palestinian refugees in your country. How many of them support Hamas?
Look, we've got to understand Hamas is not just an organization. Hamas is also an idea that came to acquire more acceptance as a result of the failure of the peace process to deliver the peace that Oslo and all the agreements that came after it promised. Our job has been for long now is to try and create acceptance for a different narrative that negotiations is the best way to go forward, that violence will only beget violence and war will only beget war. But our collective failure to do so has pushed people into the abyss of despair, and we see that manifesting itself in the way that you see.
Well, that was the Jordanian Foreign Minister, Ayman Safadi. As the conflict in Gaza continues, there was on Sunday one positive development. The water supply to southern Gaza is back on. US officials and then the Israeli government confirmed that the pipeline supplying water to the area has been reopened. In the past week, since the conflict began, over 1 million people have been displaced following Israel's order to the Palestinians to evacuate the north of the territory. Israeli troops have continued to mass near Gaza ahead of an expected ground offensive, but it's not clear when that offensive will happen and what form exactly it will take. I heard more on Sunday evening from our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman, who's in Jerusalem.
The briefing from the Israeli military this morning was that the timing will be a political decision. That suggests to me that they are ready from a military perspective, and that seemed to be where their statement from last night was heading. So really what they're saying is now down to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his new emergency war cabinet to make that decision. I think there'll be, you know, obviously a very large number of considerations, and one of those is about the huge sort of operation of logistics to keep supplying a front line, because the big risk of a military offensive like this, as far as the Israelis are concerned, is about getting bogged down, you know, in a very, very densely packed urban environment, because clearly they're going to be aiming towards Gaza City as one of the places in this ground invasion. That is territory that Hamas knows very well, and as the invasion force, the supply to Israeli troops will be, you know, one of the key considerations to them. But the answer to your question is we still don't know when. It doesn't feel like to me it's absolutely imminent, as in the coming hours or tonight, but as I say, we don't know.
And just quickly, maybe Tony Blinken, I think, back in Israel tomorrow, so it would seem unlikely to be Monday.
Yeah, I mean, he said he will arrive on Monday. And yeah, I think that's probably a pretty logical conclusion, that he wouldn't be saying that if there was a ground offensive about to start. One of the key things he's looking at is this humanitarian crisis gripping Gaza. He mentioned that the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt may reopen. Now, that would probably be for a very short amount of time to let some foreign nationals and dual Palestinian passport holders come out, but crucially to let aid convoys go in with supplies, you know, reaching this absolutely critical breaking point. Warnings from doctors that hospitals are on the verge of collapse.
And on the water supply, what's your assessment of Israel's decision to reopen the supply to the south of Gaza?
Well, I think that too was under American pressure. And as you said, we had this announcement that the resupply would start to the south. Now, speaking to our colleague Rushdi Abu Alouf in Khan Yunis now, where he is, where he's fled with his family to safety from Gaza City, he's saying that there isn't water supply, because with the power out, the water can't be pumped. I mean, that water is polluted anyway, the tap water, with seawater, so most of it is undrinkable. You still need bottled water or truckloads of clean water to be brought in. That was always the case in Gaza, so it may not be the kind of silver lining that some people were hoping.
Tom Bateman speaking to me from Jerusalem. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has released a statement appealing for Hamas to release all of its hostages immediately and without preconditions. Mr. Guterres also made a demand for Israel to grant rapid and unimpeded access for humanitarian supplies to civilians in Gaza. He said the UN had stocks of food, water, non-food items, medical supplies and fuel, all of which could be dispatched within hours. Now, as we've reported, Israel has urged Palestinians to move from the northern parts of Gaza to the south as it prepares for the next phase of its military operation against Hamas. Some people, though, are refusing to go. Mohamed Shertay has stayed in Gaza City in the north with his family. He told my colleague Johnny Diamond what life is like.
No food, no water, no electricity, no fuel. Where I shall go? What I have to do? I just staying just at home. Trying to make the kids not become very scared. If you are in Gaza, you're hearing only the drones over the sky, over the people. The aircraft, they are bombing lights to check the areas, bombing rockets, bombs to the houses. That's the voice that we hear. We cannot do or go anywhere. Everywhere they are bombing.
Have you been outside of your home? Have you been to any of the hospitals?
I saw the hospital. It became full of IDPs, even the hospital. The ambulances over there, they cannot go anywhere because they even attacked some ambulances. They cannot provide the service.
Who is with you in your home right now?
I have my father, my parents-in-law, my aunt, my wife and kids. My daughter, it's 12, my son, 11, and the little one, 7.
And what do you tell them about what is going on?
First day, I let them, we did like session for drawing. Yeah. We imagine we drawed and we colored the all international states flags. The second day, we become play sports. The third day, we opened the school's book to read. I cannot lie on them. I just only think we have hope. Might be Allah will survive us. As long we are pray for Allah to survive us.
Is there anywhere safe for you to go?
Where shall I go? There are no place to go. 10 days back, I was in Israel. I just came back to get a vacation. And I stuck. And even stuck with my family. I was begging to remove. To relocate my address to the West Bank for the safer area. But I couldn't, it's not mine. I know Gaza Strip, it's always having this catastrophic escalation. Always we lost. It's become like action and reaction. And I believe I am, as one of the people, I'm the loser between both.
Well, that was Mohamed Shertay, who remains a resident in Gaza City. As Israel prepares for its ground offensive on Gaza, what are the country's intentions? The Israeli ambassador to the UK is Tzipi Hotovli. My colleague Owen Bennett-Jones asked her if northern Gaza should be permanently depopulated.
The thing we want to remove is Hamas headquarters. We're not against civilians. So actually the question is how the end game will look after Hamas headquarters and, of course, all the underground city. Think about it. So I don't know how Gaza is going to look after the military operation is done, but I know Hamas won't be there. So we have nothing against the civilians in Gaza. Actually, we want to keep them protected and we are creating shelters for them. And this is Hamas that is preventing them to get there.
Well, just to sort of comment on that, because I did put that direct, because I'd heard that and put that point directly to two people today who've made the move, and they both said that wasn't the case, that they were free to move.
Every person that lives in Gaza was called to find a shelter in southern Gaza. We want to make sure that won't be civilians involved, and this is why we call the people of Gaza in the last 48 hours, we call them to move to the southern area of Gaza, including together with international organizations, create shelters for them.
We talked to the Jordanian foreign minister earlier. He said he just couldn't see the end point of this, in that, you know, you've made it very clear the objective is to destroy Hamas. He thought, you know, you can kill 300,000 maybe in Gaza, you know, whatever you do, there'll still be, if not Hamas, then another group that has their ideas. Do you worry about that?
I think this argument is irrelevant. Because think about the Western troops fighting ISIS and making sure that ISIS won't have the ability to kill any more innocent people. So this is the way we operate. Americans did that with Al-Qaeda. The international coalition did that with ISIS. And Hamas must be treated in the same way. So the international community knows how to fight terrorism. And this is what we need to do.
I guess what I'm asking is, do you think to ultimately solve this, it will need a political settlement? Or can it be done with military means? Because, you know, military means have been going on for decades now, and it doesn't seem to go away. I mean, that's, I guess, the point.
In order to have a political settlement, you need to have leadership in Gaza that doesn't have as ideology, like the Hamas charter, basically to eliminate the Jewish state and to see it as a holy thing to do, to kill innocent Jews. You can't have political arrangements with Hamas ideology that is exactly the same like Al-Qaeda and ISIS ideology. The only thing they want to achieve, and I think they show to the world their true face, is killing innocent Jews in their beds, in their living rooms, in their houses, walking street from street and doing those horrible, horrific attacks.
The Israeli ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Hotovli. Well, we heard earlier about concerns regarding the possibility that the conflict might develop on the Israel-Lebanon border. A missile fired into Israel from Lebanon has killed one person, the first civilian to die on Israel's northern border in the current conflict. Three others were wounded. One of the biggest factions in Lebanon is Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Islamist group that's widely regarded as a terror organization, including by the Arab League. Hezbollah said it had fired a missile which hit the village of Shatula near the border between the two countries. The Israeli military says it's retaliating by striking targets in southern Lebanon. Our correspondent, Anna Foster, is near the border.
You can hear overhead the sound of fire whistling through the air. It's been near enough an hour now. We've taken cover in a wooded area quite close to the border. You can hear all the time the sound of fire going between Israel and Lebanon. Most of it seems to be coming from the side that we're actually on, the Israeli side, towards Lebanon. But there's been return fire in the other direction as well. And I would say, judging by the length of time we've been here, as I say, nearly an hour or so, this is the longest exchange that there has been over this border since the war in the south began.
Anna Foster. Still to come.
Rundown warehouses in rural Greece seem like an unlikely target for a heist.
But what is inside? Is it money, gold, jewellery? No, they are used to store olive oil.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat the story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
World has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
This is the story of one of fashion's dark secrets.
I was overwhelmed. Like, I had never seen anything like this.
At the height of Abercrombie & Fitch's success.
This was me being carefully manipulated.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Investigating allegations that would take me into a world of money, sex, and power. This is World of Secrets. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, there is what could be very significant news emerging from Poland. Voters there have been casting their ballots in a general election. That was the sound of celebration on Sunday evening at the opposition party headquarters after exit polls, and they are still just exit polls as we record this podcast, have nonetheless predicted that the ruling Law and Justice Party has lost its majority. The leader of the main opposition party, the former European Council President Donald Tusk, said it was a victory for democracy.
I have been a politician and a sportsman for many years. I've never been so happy in my life with its second place. Poland has won. Democracy has won. We removed them from power.
Well, I spoke with our Warsaw correspondent, Adam Easton, and I asked him, scenes of celebrations, but these are very early exit polls. So Donald Tusk says it's his victory. Is he right?
Too early to say. All we can say at the moment is this is an exit poll, so that's a prediction. We've got no official results, but the exit poll is showing us that the Law and Justice Party won the most seats, but it lost its majority quite comfortably. And significantly, three opposition parties who are potential coalition partners won enough to have a comfortable majority in Parliament. Now, a crucial factor here is the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, who is an ally of the Law and Justice Party. He is the man who gets to appoint the prime minister and who has the first chance to form a government. And he has said, as is the tradition in Polish elections, that he will appoint the leader of the largest party in the election, which, according to this exit poll prediction, is the Law and Justice Party to try and form this government. But it appears that the Law and Justice has no route to a majority because its potential coalition partners didn't win enough seats either in this exit poll. So it's looking pretty good for the coalition of opposition parties under the leader of the main opposition party, Donald Tusk, who you heard.
Just quickly, Donald Tusk, I mean, in terms of a victory, if it is his, whatever the result is, it seems that the voters have turned out in their largest numbers, I think, since what, 1989?
Yeah, it's again just an exit poll prediction, but it's 73%, highest since the fall of communism in 1989. And significantly, the highest turnout was amongst the 18 to 29-year-olds, the young people who more of them voted for Mr. Tusk's party than anyone else, and more of them voted than the over-60s who generally tend to vote for Law and Justice.
Adam Easton speaking to me from Warsaw. Next, to the war in Ukraine. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has said his troops are making gains around the eastern and southern front lines. There's been intense fighting close to the city of Avdiivka, an industrial hub. Ukraine's military, however, says it's still in control of the area. From Kyiv, here's our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse.
Invading Russian forces are trying to tighten their noose around Avdiivka. They control territory to the north, east and south of the city, and seem to be making a push after 4 months of a Ukrainian counter-offensive, which Vladimir Putin claims is failing. Our troops are improving their position in almost all of this area, which is quite vast, he said on Russian state television. This concerns the areas of the Kupiansk, Zaporizhia and Avdiivka directions. The city has been on the front line for the past 9 years, since Russia backed separatists in the east of the country. While Ukrainian forces acknowledge the Russians, in their words, have not stopped assaulting Avdiivka in recent days, they claim to still be in control. Around 1,600 people still live in the city. Before the war, it was more than 30,000.
Afghanistan has been struck by its third earthquake in a week, killing at least two people and injuring more than 150. The previous tremors killed more than 1,300 people and flattened whole villages. From Kabul, here's our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Limai.
Dozens of people were rushed to Herat's main hospital after another major earthquake struck a rural area that lies to the northwest of Afghanistan's third largest city. The facility is already full, and while aid agencies have been pitching in, it is still a struggle to treat the injured. Although the magnitude of the earthquake was as severe as the first one, the number of deaths is low because people have been sleeping outdoors, too scared to go into their homes. The region has witnessed multiple earthquakes and big aftershocks over the past week. Thousands have been left homeless, and as winter approaches, the Taliban government says food, clothes, tents and other aid is urgently needed.
The president of Azerbaijan has visited the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, raising his country's flag in the main city. Karabakh was retaken by Azerbaijan's forces last month. Ian McWilliam has this report.
President Ilham Aliyev, wearing military camouflage, kissed the flag before it was raised. He said taking control of the region from Armenian separatists had been the chief aim of his 20-year rule. The main city is called Stepanakert by Armenians or Khankendi by Azerbaijanis. Nearly all of Karabakh's Armenian population of 120,000 fled the territory in the wake of a lightning one-day offensive by Azerbaijan last month. On Sunday, Pope Francis, speaking in Rome, called for the protection of Karabakh's ancient Armenian Christian monasteries and churches.
We're going to Greece now, where there's been a string of high-profile thefts in the country. But the target isn't money or jewellery, it's olive oil. Aina Aslam reports.
Rundown warehouses in rural Greece seem like an unlikely target for a heist. But thieves have broken through the iron doors to steal more than $300,000 worth of olive oil in recent weeks, amid a shortage of the so-called liquid gold. There have also been reports of people breaking into homes to steal oil from kitchen pantries and raiding cemeteries where stockpiles are kept for use in vigil lamps. After thefts of olive oil and olives, farmers are worried criminals may begin targeting the olive trees next. Many are already struggling to make a living after heat waves and drought led to two consecutive bad harvests. Olive oil is a staple in the Mediterranean diet, but as prices continue to skyrocket, a third of Greeks have switched to cheaper alternatives like sunflower oil. A similar spate of robberies in Spain earlier this year led to supermarkets placing locks on olive oil bottles, usually seen on alcohol. Farmers in the region have blamed what they call the unprecedented poor harvests on climate change. Extreme weather events have recently led to food shortages across the world, with tomatoes being taken off the menu at McDonald's in India and hot sauce lovers in Mexico feeling the sting of red jalapeno scarcity.
Aina Aslam reporting. Now, the American actress Piper Laurie has died. She was 91. In a career spanning several decades, she was best known for playing a domineering and deranged mother in the horror film Carrie in 1976. Her performance chilled audiences and earned her an Oscar nomination.
No! No! No!
Help the sinning woman see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood would never have come on her.
Well, Piper Laurie also secured Oscar nominations for her roles in The Hustler and Children of a Lesser God. While on television, she's best remembered for the series Twin Peaks. At one point, she took a lengthy break from acting to campaign for the American Civil Rights Movement. Now to the world of animation and film. Founded by two brothers 100 years ago, the Walt Disney Company has grown from a small animation studio in California to what is now a multi-billion dollar entertainment conglomerate, which has captured the hearts and minds of many generations and embedded itself into popular culture. To mark its centenary, a huge exhibition of rarely seen artefacts is travelling around the world over the next 5 years. It's currently here in London, where our reporter Iona Hampson was given a special tour.
The Walt Disney Archives have opened its vaults to capture the technical innovation and the breadth of stories the company has told over the past 100 years.
My name is Becky Klein, and I'm the director of the Walt Disney Archives.
How on earth do you capture 100 years of something so vast and so imaginative?
That was the big challenge with creating this exhibition. What we did is, instead of telling a chronological story, we decided what we would do is go back to our very roots, to 1923, and Walt Disney and Roy Disney, our founders, and look at what they did that we're still doing today. We do a little bit of chronological storytelling at the very beginning, so you're introduced to Walt Disney and his story, and you see the earliest years of the company and the silent cartoons and the things up to the birth of Mickey Mouse. And then instead of going on chronologically, we tell each gallery represents one of Walt Disney's philosophies.
While many will enjoy the exhibition with their families, I went around it with some very unique guests.
In the morning, I'll start with a simple, and then I know that if I can do that scale, I know I can do it. And then I'll start with a,
oh boy, hiya pal, it's me, Mickey Mouse.
I'm Brett Iwin. I am the official voice of Mickey Mouse, and I've had that distinguishing pleasure since 2009.
And when you go to an exhibition like this and see Mickey everywhere, do you think, that's me?
No, I think Mickey is Mickey. When I see Mickey, I see Mickey Mouse. You know, I turn into the little kid and I giggle along like everybody else does.
A couple of steps away from the Star Wars objects, I can see the Captain America shield with a star in the center. I can see the long red dress that Emma Stone wore as Cruella, and also the artwork used to develop the visuals for the 1953 animation Peter Pan. It really shows how varied the stories are that Disney's been able to show over the years. And the exhibition also shows what goes on behind the scenes to make these stories come to life.
Hi, I'm Eric Goldberg, and I'm an animator and director for Walt Disney Animation Studios.
You are surrounded by Disney, as you probably are for many, many years. What do you think it's captured really well?
The breadth of what the Disney company has done and what Walt has done, these pictures on a wall or monitors is a trigger for people to go, oh, yeah, I remember that. It kind of reminds people how much a part of their lives Disney is.
Some of Disney's past productions have been criticized for their stereotypical portrayal of non-white characters and elements of sexism. They're issues the company has attempted to address in remakes with more diverse casting and revised scripts, a move that has brought Disney into a wider cultural debate. Dr. Sabrina Mittermeier from the University of Kassel in Germany researches the Walt Disney Company.
They've gone with the times and, like, you know, what demographics they want to attract. Overall, they're still very middle of the road with a lot of this. And I think they couldn't just make films about princesses anymore now, and they shouldn't be doing that either. We're now at a point where people have nostalgia for the films of the 90s. What I grew up with is already old and is already getting updated again for newer audiences, because we've also realized there's some stuff in there that's maybe no longer going with the times in terms of, like, feminism, depiction of women, etc.
There are two similar exhibitions that will travel internationally. While one unit will remain in London until January, the second unit will be shown in the US city of Chicago from November, with more locations around the world announced soon.
Well, that report by Iona Hampson and Mickey Mouse, kind of. That's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Hewitt. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Uncover from CBC Podcasts is your source for exceptional storytelling and groundbreaking journalism. Unveil the shocking secrets of one of Canada's most prolific fashion moguls. Dissect the events that led to the city of Philadelphia dropping a bomb on a family of American citizens. And dive into the unsolved murders of two Canadian billionaires. The very best in award-winning true crime. Uncover, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Kathleen Goldhar, and I'm the host of a new podcast, Crime Story. Every week, we bring you a different crime, told by the storyteller who knows it best.
You got one witness who can't be found. You got another witness who's murdered.
We couldn't sugarcoat this story.
I was getting calls from Cosby's attorney threatening to sue every day.
Every crime in one way or another is a reflection of who we are as a people, as a city, as a country.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.